The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Yeah, let me welcome you. My name's Tim Patrick, and it's great to all be together for this first event in the Reason for Faith Festival that's running this week throughout Melbourne CBD. Bruce is Senior Research Fellow at the Australian Research Centre, is that correct? Australian Research Council's Centre for Excellence for Particle Physics at the Terascale. We might find out more about what that actually means. Based in the School of Physics at the Faculty of Science at the University of Sydney. So as we begin, let me just ask if you would please then welcome Bruce to our conversation this afternoon. I hope that I have done some justice in introducing you. I feel, even though we've talked many times, and even though I myself have a background in science and research science, I'm out of my depth very quickly. I wonder if you could help us, just to start the conversation, by telling us what it is you do. What is it that your working life looks like?
So there's really two questions there. One is, the second one is, what does my average day look like? And that changes from year to year. And the other is the kind of work that I do. And I'll answer that question instead. Particle physics is concerned with the structure and the behaviour of matter. And I'll use matter loosely speaking, at the very smallest scales. So if you remember your chemistry, things are made up of molecules, molecules are made up of atoms, atoms have a nucleus in the middle, that's made up of protons and neutrons. You probably didn't know that protons and neutrons have quarks inside them, and the nucleus has electrons going around the outside. It's once you get down to that very smallest level that starts to be my job. And so the length scales involved are very small, so 10 to the minus 15 metres is a useful sort of unit at that point. So that's a let's see if I fail to embarrass myself, it's a millionth of a millimetre. So a nucleus is big by my standards, big-ish, and it's a behaviour of matter at that scale. That's what I do, what my colleagues and I do.
The behaviour of matter at that scale.
Yep.
Now, this is an obvious question in some ways, but this is uncharted territory. Is that right?
No. Again, like many things where there's been great progress this century, it's been sort of symbiotic with growth in technology. Mm-hmm. So as the technology's improved, we've been able to increase the energies of the particle beams that you use as probes. That's gone up over time, and that has reduced the length scales mm-hmm. that we can probe. So a primitive version of that is the cathode ray tubes in old televisions. For those of you who remember televisions that had some visual depth, and bulk, the electron gun running the back of that is a baby particle accelerator running with electrons. Basically, we've got better and better and better at making those, mm-hmm. and so the length scale on which we've been able to probe matter mm-hmm. has gone down and down, because the greater the energy, the smaller the scale of length mm-hmm. you can probe. And so whereas most of the fundamental particles really were only known from cosmic radiation or whatever in the first part of last century, second half of the century we learnt increasingly more about that from particle accelerator experiments. And now, of course, at CERN, we're probing very small length scales, very high energies indeed. That'll do for the moment, I hope.
So tell us about how an experiment runs. You're obviously based in Sydney for a lot of the time. You're obviously working on a data set. How's the data set collected? What are you doing?
Yes, so the size of the experiments has gone up over time as well, as they've grown in... Physically, they've gotten bigger as the energies involved have gotten larger, and the sophistication has gone up and the complication has gone up. So my PhD experiment, there were about 150 physicists working together. The experiment I'm working on now, depending on how you count it, there's about 3,000.
Okay.
And my PhD experiment was the size of a small house, physically, the detector. Atlas is the size of the physics building at Sydney University. The data taking rates have also gone up.
Mm-hmm.
The sophistication of the data has gone up again. That's improvements there largely to do with improvements in semiconductor technology. We can make detectors on chips now, and we do so.
Mm-hmm.
And so the data coming out of Atlas, there's 100 million electronic channels that are read out.
Right.
For every interaction. And the data has to be filtered because you couldn't cope with all of the data that came out of it. There'd be no way to record it.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of the computational sophistication has gone up as well, but the sort of work that I do personally isn't even data reduction. It's about sort of what does the data mean. I'm one of the people that looks at a plot and says, something's wrong with that, did you check that?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of one of the things that I do personally. Whereas I have colleagues who are into gonzo script writing, others who are actually electronics people, others of whom are semiconductor experts, other people who are mathematically sophisticated. So there's a saying, there's a whole bunch of people, hides underneath it an enormous amount of specialisation. So again, like the course of the 20th century generally, increasing specialisation and cooperative work on large projects.
What would be the... when you say your work is to describe the behaviour of subatomic particles,
yep.
In lay terms, for those of us who don't understand how they may or may not behave,
mm-hmm.
what are the kinds of things that you're hoping to be able to say at the conclusion of the experiment, or should you have success with your experiment?
Yeah, depends on the experiment. So going with Atlas for the moment, which is sort of more in the news, everyone thinks physics is complicated. Physics isn't. Physics is actually about simple things. And because lots of people's interaction with it as a subject is from school, I mean, at parties I get from people, I'll sort of shuffle their feet, I was never really any good at maths, and embarrassment of seeing nod from a colleague in the audience. Physics is about things that are either very small or very big or very simple. If it's two out of those three things, then it's definitely physics, and if it's one out of those three things, then it's probably physics. Really, it's about simple things. So you remember your periodic table from chemistry or science classes at school, yeah? The equivalent of that for particles is much simpler. It's much smaller, it's much more highly structured, and transparent, much more highly structured. It's smaller, the structure is simpler and more apparent to the eye. And one of the things that Atlas is after is missing parts of that periodic table, if you like, at the absolutely most fundamental scale. So it's what are the fundamental bits and bobs that are out there.
Right.
And will that do for the moment?
Yes, that's right. And that was leading me to where I was going to go, because my question was, why do it? I mean, this is a pure enterprise, a pure research enterprise, just to determine that very question. Is that right?
That's my motivation, and perhaps the majority of the people in the field would give something like that. The cultural understanding things, there is a mountain, let's climb it, there is a rainbow, gee, isn't that beautiful, but why the colours in that order and why at that particular angle, there must be a principle behind that. Maybe if... You know, that it's that sort of combination of aesthetics, wonder, actually there are principles that are amenable to human and mathematical understanding that you can go out and find that draw some of this stuff together. Let's do that, presumably, as part of what we're here for. That's my motivation.
Recently, people who are talking about questions of theism, atheism, pull out the physics card and almost play it as though, because physics is very sophisticated in lots of ways, we can then make proclamations about the existence or non-existence of God. I don't want to go that far right now, but I want to ask you, although because research is research and every step leads to another step, in the current world of high-energy physics research, what are the kinds of things that may be understood, and what's actually beyond that? Like, there are presumably questions that you're asking that are the right and sensible questions to ask, and there are questions that are just outside the scope of what physics really addresses in terms of what people are really doing today.
Yep, okay. So, going with the previous discussion, I think it's probably helpful to draw a distinction between the aspirations or motivations of a discipline and a discipline as a technical body of knowledge, as a thing of understanding. And so there's, taking as read all my discussion of why we do what we do, that's not actually what we do from one day to the next. I mean, I spent a large fraction of my time for a year a few years ago working on a single paper. It's 15 pages long. It's in Physical Review D. There would be probably only the number of people in this room who've read it through from beginning to end. Some hundreds of people would have dipped into it. And it's all about a particular technical measurement that says what it says and doesn't say what it doesn't say, and that's it. And lots of scientific work, I mean, you would remember this from your own geological work, is like that. You answer the questions that you can address. So you've got the methods that you can bring to play, whatever theoretical framework that you have that you can use, and the amount of time and brain wattage that you bring to the problem, and you address what you can address. Now that changes as a function of time. So the sorts of questions we can answer now are different to the sorts of questions we could answer even 10, 15 years ago. Some of the questions that were live questions during my PhD, or that even motivated the experiment that I did my PhD on, are dead questions now. Not because they were never interesting, but because we know more now than we knew then, and sort of either the field of interest has moved, or my PhD experiment was interesting because a certain question was unresolved. That question is actually resolved now, and so you wouldn't do that experiment again if it had never been done before, if that sort of makes sense. And so people ask about what the limits of this, and I mean, you asked what the limits of physics are. I don't know what the limits of physics are. I can tell you what the limits of my current experiments are within a certain time horizon, but not really beyond that, because I was surprised by lots of the developments. So I did my PhD on neutrino physics. Neutrinos have been in the news lately, as you may have noticed. I was surprised by most of the key results in neutrino physics about 10, 12 years ago, and so was most of the rest of the neutrino community. And so the kinds of questions that become open and closed change over time. But you think about the way I described physics. Physics is ultimately about simple things. Now, it doesn't really do complicated questions. Once something becomes too complicated, we actually hand the question off to someone else as a demarcation matter and call it chemistry, or call it geology, or call it something else. And those and those scientists actually have different methods mm. and different things that they're good or bad at. But that, of course, doesn't mean that. But the questions that you can answer with physics are surprising if you don't have the scientific knowledge yourself. Mm. If that makes sense, you need to understand the field in order to have a sense for what the reach of the field is.
Mm-hmm.
And someone outside the field can't legislate it, because not just because it's an open inquiry, but just because it's non-trivial. You know, there's more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in my or your philosophy, and certainly in the philosophy of someone like you or me 100 years ago. And so you just have to run with it.
Can I make the leap then via Shakespeare?
Okay.
Which is probably not really a leap via Shakespeare. But I want to change gears. And I want to, before moving into some more conceptual questions, I touched before on the fact that, as well as being a working physicist and having a real active involvement in the research that's truly going on in the world today, you've also studied theology.
Yep.
Can you tell us a bit about what does that mean?
What does theology mean, or what does me studying theology mean?
What does studying theology mean? A real question at one level, because for some people that might mean something very different to what you actually did. So what did it look like for you to study theology?
It was a fairly extreme exercise in interdisciplinary study, mm-hmm. if you like. Something that would actually be much more natural in the university environment now than it was 20 years ago, which is when I did it.
Mm-hmm.
When there was a sort of strong bias against people switching fields or taking time out early in their career, particularly for scientists. I don't know if anyone of similar age might remember the background. So think of it as an extreme version of the kid who takes a year out to study German and English literature mm-hmm. or something like that.
But you didn't do it just as a hobby. I mean, you did a full degree.
Some people probably would have thought of it as a hobby. Some of my colleagues thought mm-hmm, it was mm-hmm. either frivolous or mm-hmm. Misguided or whatever on either side mm-hmm. of the divide. I did it because I was interested. I did it because I could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a set of historical circumstances around that I won't bore you with. And I was young and idealistic and up for, you know, something a little crazy, like doing a couple of fundamental degrees back to back in different disciplines that don't get on with each other, and that really, I mean, I do class it as an exercise in interdisciplinary work,
mm-hmm.
And one of the things I took away from it is just interdisciplinary work is hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really hard, and you, particularly if you come from deep in a particular, especially if you come from deep in a particular discipline, you'll come to another discipline probably asking the wrong questions.
Mm.
Not in the sense that they're bad questions, you know, sort of, you know, wicked, but just not questions that are easy to answer mm. or questions that haven't interested or motivated the other people involved in the discipline, or that you can't bring the techniques to bear on, or the rest of it. Yeah, will that do for the moment?
That's helpful, yes, and it takes me to where I want to go, which I think really is the nub of what we want to start thinking about, or thinking more about, which is really about the interplay. I mean, we could talk a lot more about both disciplines. We could talk about your work in physics, that is, I find fascinating, although I have to admit a lot of it is very hard for me to get my head around. We can talk about theology. Where do the two meet? We often hear people who are strong in physics, for example, or have a strong scientific background, they're making proclamations that are theological. And we, of course, see vice versa as well. People who are theologically trained or have a particular religious yeah. faith making proclamations about what science does or doesn't say. Mm-hmm. I want to ask, What do they tell us about each other? What does true research physics tell us about theology, about God?
In my opinion, not a lot. I think there's a temptation to confusion here, and it partly comes from the fact that they're both fundamental disciplines. Mm-hmm. So physics is fundamental in the sense that physics does the simple, and as far as we understand, the natural world is simple at its heart, in the sense that if you keep dividing up the things on this table and you keep going down to the stuff that everything's made of and you look at those things, those are simple. The laws under which they interact with each other are simple. Like I said, it's really quite a... I could do it on the back of an envelope, mm-hmm. if you really wanted. And in that sense, physics is fundamental. That everyone, most scientists would regard chemistry as just emerging trivially from physics. Not meaning that it's easy or that what chemists do isn't important, but that there's no mystery. There's nothing there philosophically hard going on. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, physics is fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to ask about the structure of the Earth, I mean, the Earth is a complicated thing and you want to do geology on it, but you can do physics on it,
mm-hmm.
and the physics will get you a surprisingly long way. And in the end, the geology really boils down to physics and chemistry, and the chemistry ultimately boils down to physics. In that sense, physics is fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
And theology is a fundamental discipline in the sense that you're asking the very big banner questions. But the technical day-to-day work that you would do in either is just not the same. Like that, but they do meet at various places, and that's what you want to know.
Tell us where they meet.
All right. So, 19th century, cusp of the 20th, people's understanding of the history of the world, the long, painful collapse of literal Genesis 1-3 geology, biology, history, whatever, in the 19th century. That occurred through geology in the first instance, and then only quite late in the century through biology. I mean, it started before Darwin, and Darwin made it respectable.
Mm-hmm.
Physicists were among the critics. And Lord Kelvin is the example that everyone drags out, because physicists have a reputation for arrogance towards other scientific disciplines, which is fairly well earned. So chemists knew about atoms decades before we did, and some of us didn't believe them. We were wrong, they were right. And one of the things is that they didn't know about radioactivity in the 19th century, and so not only did they not know how the centre of the Earth could be hot, they didn't know how the stars burned. And Lord Kelvin said, look, there just isn't enough time for all of the geological history that your predecessors were coming up with. So you've done something wrong. And that would have been a perfectly sound argument, except that radioactivity does exist. You can power a star by fusion. The sun can be old, and in fact is, and it wasn't your predecessors who hadn't done their work properly. It was just something that we hadn't found yet.
Mm-hmm.
But so something like that, that does bear on what's possible. So 300 years ago, a reading that the Earth was 6,000 years old was not obviously absurd. You might have argued on philosophical grounds that it was unpleasing, or you might have thought, look, I think Genesis is a terrible book, why do I care about it? But it wasn't obviously absurd. By the end of the 19th century it was, and the sciences bore on that. Now, how central you think that question is to theology is itself a theological question and a cultural one almost, because that's played out differently in different in different faith traditions, in different cultures. It's different in the Germanic world than it is in the Anglophone, and so
it's certainly been seen, I believe, as a chink in the armour of the theist. But in a strange way, I mean, it's an old thing. This is not something that's just kind of been discovered in the last 10 years, as you say.
That question isn't, and the whole the question of why questions like that have a cultural persistence, despite all of the interesting arguments having been had really a long time ago, all the interesting arguments, that nothing that I said in the last 10 minutes was new or has been new for any long time. And in that sense, the grounds of the debate haven't shifted. That's a cultural question, and, you know, give me a couple of beers, I'll give you a cultural commentary, but that's not what you got me here for.
No.
So, but I think that's a cultural question. I mean, it's not to say that in an individual life, those questions can't be current, because, you know, you come from a particular family, you went to a particular church, you went to a particular school, God help you. That question might, those sort of questions might be real and current, but in that sense they're frustrating to a scientist, because the natural sciences progress and there are certain questions that we just don't rehash, and the rehashing of questions that are actually resolved is a reliable way of annoying a scientist, because we're not, because our disciplines progress, we tend not to be particularly good at history. And the history of science and of scientific inquiry is in a sense a different discipline. It's a different optimization setting for your education. You would read different textbooks or study different things if it were the history you were interested in, rather than the cutting edge. Because it's not like political questions or cultural ones that keep looping back on themselves. The scientists do move forward. And, yeah.
I've got a couple more questions that I'd love to get to, but I think just for the sake of time, I'd like to throw it open. We probably only really have time for a couple. Is there anyone who would like to throw something into the mix? Sorry, John.
Well, I don't quite know what at a metaphysical level means. And I'm possibility, presumably, I don't do model building in this area. I'm not a biologist. If you make a statement, once you've accepted there is a God, if you then start making a statement, God can't quote-unquote interfere with the world or do something to it or change something, you say, well, on what basis do you say that, and what are your grounds for saying that? This becomes an aesthetic question quite quickly. And if you wanted to ask what's the mechanism for that or how does that work, that's a technical question in a sub area of theology that's got a sort of a sciencey flavour, but it's not what I do, and I don't quite understand the motivation for it. Because I think the question, if you don't accept there's a God, then it's not clear, or if you're not even prepared to entertain the question, then it's not clear why a question like that is interesting. And if you do, then I think the question's of a technical nature, and physics would condition that question. Like, if you think the world is made of little billiard balls, or if you think the world is made from things that obey field equations, then how something like that looks will look different technically. But I don't think physics drives that.
I might take another.
there is not a consensus position. So what is knowable or discussable in cosmology has expanded as a field in the last 15, 20 years, but by a related process to the one that I was talking about earlier in my own discipline, largely to do with satellite-borne instruments, and there just being a whole lot more data. There is not a consensus position. Some of the options sound fairly outlandish. There are physicists who think that some of the options are outlandish as well, but those mightn't quite line up with what sort of man in the street perception, because some of the established stuff in the discipline is quite outlandish. Just happens to be well attested. Before the Big Bang, no, not a consensus position. Well, so, maybe. I didn't hear the discussion. So again, see, this is, in this sense, physics is about numbers. It's about numbers, it's not about poetry. And if you want to do a thermodynamic accounting for a system, you have to do it in a closed system, or if you've left the system open, you have to keep track of all of its pieces. And the sun and the earth and things involved in them, the pieces of that system are now 4.5 billion light years out. Every single infrared photon radiated by the Earth as part of its black body spectrum, well, it's not black body, but just as part of its thermal radiation, spreading out all through its entire history, is part of that thermodynamic accounting. And so you don't get to look at an individual piece of the system walking around, say, gee, that's fairly complicated, and say, you know, hey, there's something wrong with this. If you need to do the sums on entropy, you have to take everything into account. People point out, so just something as simple as gravity is counterintuitive in this regard. Just the what used to be called the nebula hypothesis, how you form something like a solar system by a cloud of gas and dust collapsing on itself. That looks amorphous and uncomplicated and the rest of it. And then what you get at the end with a, you know, big heavy point in the middle glowing with stuff rotating around, it looks nice and organised, and all of the rest of it, that doesn't violate the second law of thermodynamics. The entropy gets ported. There is extra entropy in the system at the end than there was at the beginning. You've got to take everything into account, not just the big attentive bits that you look at. I've never done an accounting. One assumes so, but physics is not a monolithic discipline.
Yes.
No. Historically, clearly, this sort of thing has led people to different hypotheses. So, for anyone who knows about the history of cosmology, the steady state cosmology would be an example that was driven by, call them aesthetic criteria, call them philosophical, call them theological criteria, whatever. As far as I'm concerned, that's fine, provided that the discussion then plays out within the discipline. And the steady state cosmology died because the evidence didn't support it. And, you know, the Big Bang is called the Big Bang because it was an insult, you know, because people deprecated it as an idea. It won in the end because the evidence was there. So my research program probably wouldn't be that different to someone doing the same sort of work, except perhaps in the I'm a little skeptical of grand physics narratives, if you will, as an answer for everything. But you could call, I don't really know if that's because I'm a believer and have sort of other groundings, or it's just my history. Like I said, I mean, my PhD field is one in which it's difficult to work and where the results kept surprising us. And so you could offer that as a grounding for my scepticism, or just the fact that I'm the age I am. You know, who knows?
Can we... I think we may have time for one more question. Might come back here. Assuming that you predict the answer will be brief.
Just getting back to the Big Bang question.
Well, it's not something for which you could really adduce observational evidence. But again, these things are difficult for an outsider to assess. So one of the reasons that... There are technical reasons why people have gone for multiverse discussions, one of which comes from string theory. And so if you take string theory seriously, then a multiverse option does pop up fairly naturally, and that pushes the question one stage further back. I mean, protest has been raised in the discipline at, if you like, the profligacy of an hypothesis that involves, you know, 10 to the 120 possible states or the rest of it. But again, we've had versions of that sort of discussion before, and as far as I'm concerned, that's all fair game, provided that it plays out within the discipline. Opinions are strongly divided on string theory within physics, but that in itself is a kind of a demarcation dispute, if you like. It's a fight between a certain kind of speculative mathematical physics and the kind of esoteric experimental physics that I do. And again, I think you want to be slow to pick sides in a dispute between two disciplines where they cross each other, because my people have been wrong before, but you know, let the evidence decide it.
I think we're going to have to wrap up there just so we can head back to the office in time. I'll just make a few notes just to finish. I think it's been a great conversation, and I'm sure you'll agree we could go on and on and on. For me, I think what's been very helpful has been just to think about this note we ended on, the demarcation of disciplines, and the whole idea of academic trespass and people walking into areas that are not their strong, not their training, not the discipline, and presuming to profess there, or as Bruce said, to have debates that are cross-discipline without understanding each other. I hope this has helped us grow a little more in our understanding. A few things to do just so we wrap up. You will have gotten this little feedback form when you came in. It'd be really great and helpful to us if you'd like to fill that in. There should be pens around, and if you take a moment just to jot down your thoughts there, any reflections you have, and if you'd like to know more about the City Bible Forum, you can do that there. Someone will collect them from you on the way out. We'd like to just as well remind you about the remaining events, so grab hold of one of these brochures if you don't have them. This has just been the first in a series of about a dozen events where we're going to be doing similar things, having conversations to try and deepen and broaden and mature our understanding on these very complicated and important and interesting questions. So please grab them. Some of them will be held in a pub over a couple of beers, if that's your style. I'll be at them. Hope that you can join us there. Also, I'd particularly like to highlight for you Friday night. Friday night is our final event. It'll be held at the Melbourne City Conference Centre on Swanston Street, where we'd like to invite everyone to come along. And this will be a pretty straightforward presentation of what we think the Christian faith is, and hopefully stripping away some of the false ideas and the straw men, and helping people see what it is rather than what it isn't. Two last things to draw to your attention. We have, you will have noticed on the bottom of this form, an opportunity for you to, if you'd like to explore more of the Christian faith. We're going to be running a number of courses in the city. They'll be at lunchtime or after work. They'll run to a tight schedule. There'll be the same mood as this. Questions will be, everyone's questions will be welcome and engaged with and discussed seriously. We will certainly be presenting a point of view, but nothing is out of bounds, and everyone's welcome to come and participate and disagree quite freely if that's what you'd like to do. Later in the year, the City Bible Forum is going to Mexico. This is something that was done last year, part of because what we want to do as Christian believers is not just talk the talk, but we want to walk the walk. So last year, a group went along to Mexico to a very poor area and build a house for a family who otherwise would not be able to have a house. There's a project there, a group over there that does this. And we partner with them. You pay your own way. It could be a great way to use your annual leave. Go to Mexico. Spend some time not just seeing a part of the world you might not have seen before, but doing something useful and lasting for people who could really use a helping hand. That's a magnificent thing to be involved with, and be a great group of people if that's something that would excite you. And finally, as you go, please do feel free to help yourself to more lunch at the back table. We're just asking $5 to cover costs. There's also some literature you might like to take. Some's free, some has a small price. But apart from that, we'll end up. Please feel free to loiter as well if you'd like to stay, and we'll hang around for a bit and continue chatting. But if you need to dash, now's the time to go. Before we finish, though, I'd really like to ask you to join me in thanking Bruce very much for his time. Thank you very much.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.